Hi everyone, Judy here. On this week's podcast, we talk with John Andrasakis of DowDuPont about their embedded resistance materials. Wonder if you could take up to 90% of your decoupling caps off the surface of the board, embed them, and get all that real estate back, at the same time improving reliability and reducing inductance. If that sounds like something you're interested in, you're gonna love this conversation. So lean in and enjoy. Welcome to Altium's On Track podcast, where we talk to leaders about PCB design, tackling subjects ranging from schematic capture all the way to the manufacturing floor. I'm your host, Judy Warner. Please listen in every week and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all your favorite podcast apps. And be sure to check out the show notes at altium.com/podcast, where you can find great resources and multiple ways to connect with us on social media. Well, John, thanks for joining us today. I'm looking forward to this conversation and learning along with our audience about embedded capacitors. So before we take off, why don't you tell us a little bit about sort of your background in the industry and what you do now for DuPont in your current role and what that sort of entails?
Okay. Yes, I've been in the printed circuit board industry now for, I hate to say, but 38 years. And started out, I tell people I worked my way backwards on the supply chain. I started out at IBM at a facility in Endicott, and I worked through multiple companies, mostly on the material side of it. So I worked for, I did work at Hydeco, which is now Sanmina, making printed circuit boards for many years, but then worked at Oak Mitsui, with the copper foil supplier, working at Nelco and making materials, and now working for we call ourselves still DowDuPont because we're now post merger, but we're going to be splitting up, and then eventually we'll be called DuPont again, or the new DuPont.
So give us a brief overview of that, because until we spoke yesterday, that had just escaped my attention. I feel kind of silly. That seems like a huge merger. So why don't you share with our listeners in case there's other, there's three other people like me.
Well, both Dow and DuPont are very long, well-established companies, well over 100 years old each. And they were both on missions to diversify and getting to different businesses. And I think the leadership team of both companies realized they were kind of going on similar paths, but they realized that maybe it'd be better just to combine their businesses and then split off into the three distinct areas that they were concentrating on. So there's going to be an agricultural business that spins off. There's going to be the Dow business, which will be mostly like the industrial chemicals and what people think of the traditional Dow. And then DuPont will be basically kind of the remaining businesses. We call it SpecCo right now internally, but it includes the group I'm part of, which is Electronics and Imaging Group, and that is what is now the combination of the Dow Electronic Materials and the DuPont Electronic Materials Group. So it includes quite a bit, but it also includes other areas like display technology and printing technology, things of that type. So we're still going to be, even when we split in three, each of the businesses are going to be well over somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 billion plus. So we're going to still be big companies even after the split. That'll happen sometime mid-year. And what's nice about it is that now each of the core businesses, the new DuPont, the new Dow, and then the agriculture business can concentrate on its core strengths.
Right.
And so I think that's really going to help each of the individual businesses and bring more value to the industry and to the shareholders.
It sounds like it. It sounds like actually a really healthy, good merger.
Yes.
So good for you. So, well, thanks for sharing that. I don't know how that had escaped my attention, but and that happened, what'd you say, about 2 years ago?
No, actually, well, they started the negotiations and getting things ready a couple of years back, but the official merger occurred in October. Of last year.
Okay.
And, actually, it's October of 2017. Excuse me, I went to 2019. I got to remember it's not.
Yeah.
And I joined in January of 2018. So I basically joined the new merged group at that point.
Okay.
So we're about a little over a year into the combined group at this point. Okay. And there's been a number of reorganizations and optimizations and things going on, but so far everything's been really much towards the positive.
Well, let's jump in to the topic that I'm really fascinated. It doesn't sound like it's new technology. So talk to us about what exactly, and tell me if I'm getting my language right, we're calling it embedded capacitors, right? Or embedded capacitance. Which way do you call it?
Well, let's clarify. Okay, so I call it embedded capacitance. If we want to go from a historical standpoint, it was originally called buried capacitance because a company that no longer exists through mergers, Zicon, had patented this technology maybe over 20 years ago. But it was actually in use probably a little bit before that. And Zicon was bought by Hadco, which was bought by Sanmina. And so they termed the phrase buried capacitance. And so since that's their term, I like to use embedded capacitance as a more generic.
Okay.
But the difference, there are people who are embedding discrete capacitors. They actually make a cavity inside the board and place a discrete capacitor inside that cavity. And that's not what we're talking about here.
Okay.
That's something a little different. So when we say embedded capacitance, we're talking about basically a very thin power ground plane that gets inserted inside the circuit board, material in the stack up.
And while we're on the case of clarifying, we had Bruce Muller from OmegaPly, which is buried resistors. So this is completely different from that too. So just for our listeners, I want to make sure we know what we're talking about. That's a completely different and actually a more, I think, not challenging to manufacture, but there's more steps to manufacturing, I would say.
The embedded resistor technology is also interesting, but there you're actually forming discrete resistors. And so it's more of a one-to-one type of thing where you take something that would have been on the surface and you embed it down inside the circuit board. And there are quite a few multiple steps, but it is also a very tried and true technology that's been used for many years.
So how long has this technology of embedded capacitance been around?
Well, from the records that we have, it's at least, people might have been practicing some form of this as well as 30 years plus ago. But what's happened is that if you want to go by the patents, it's at least 25 years that people have been using it. And part of the reason is that there were some material limitations many years ago that the material wasn't quite good enough to, as the laminates get thinner and thinner, there's a concern about reliability. And so materials made 30 years ago are quite significantly different than what's made today. So again, that was the limitations back then. And so now with the advent of just general improvement of the circuit board materials in general, as far as clunginess and quality and improvements in the technology, make it much more feasible these days than it had maybe back then.
Okay, so why don't you just describe, you said it's a power and ground capacitive layer. Can you explain a little bit more about just what it is?
Okay, exactly. So when the technology first started out, it was really nothing more than taking a 2 mil dielectric, which was typically the same material as the rest of the board. So if you were making a 20-layer board that was high TG FR4 epoxy, this material was the same, except that in the initial days, when standard foil was being used, a lot of people call it shiny copper, where the rough side of the copper was towards a laminate to get the maximum adhesion, and the shiny side was up, that was causing a problem where the high profile could short out those very thin dielectrics. Mm-hmm. So someone came up with the bright idea of using a product called Double Treat Copper, where the copper suppliers used, they also treated the shiny side of the copper, and they just flipped it over. And they use the shiny side of the copper with a treatment on it to stick to the laminate. So now they could meet those 2 mil dielectrics without shorting out. And so that's how the origin. Now, people, turned out, do not like using double treated copper. It's very hard to handle, it's expensive. So eventually, what we call reverse treated copper foil took over. Mm-hmm. So for many years, it was a 2 mil dielectric with typically 1 or 2 ounce copper on either side using reverse treated copper foil. Okay. And that's what the majority of what used to be called BC2000, the Sanmina licensed product, was called. And okay. So for many years, people, let me get to the license real quickly, but because of those patents, Sanmina was basically set up their licensing scheme where they basically would charge a price per square foot license, you know, royalty for using the technology. And most people abided by it. It was reasonable and it worked well. And so, but since the patents are now out of date, it's pretty much open to practice by anyone.
Interesting. So what has it sort of morphed into now that better materials are available and we've come out of the licensing and now yes. that it's more open source and our materials are better, what's it sort of morphed into as far as, let's just dive into what pain points would drive somebody to want to use this embedded, what would drive someone there? I mean, I think you mentioned that your job, right, is you'll get a call or you'll reach out to OEMs that are looking yes. for this technology to do some very specific things. So what are those pain points that they're really looking to resolve, and why would they use embedded capacitance over just using decoupling caps all over the surface?
Okay. Well, the original thought process is that, you know, someone discovered that by putting, you know, way back when, that by putting the power ground planes very close together, they're getting better, lower impedance of their power distribution network, which allowed them to reduce the number of decoupling caps. And so the use of the 2 mil dielectric started to grow for those most demanding applications. And so we're talking about, you know, high-end servers, routers, switches, some military applications, things where they really wanted to improve the overall power distribution network. Mm-hmm. But the other thing, there's other reasons why people use it. Even when 2 mil was the standard, what that would allow is that when back in the day, a lot of power ground spacings were maybe 8 mils or 10 mils, and that would take up a lot of real estate in the thickness of the board.
Right.
And so, back when the average layer count was 10 or 12, you remember those days, right?
Yes, the olden days. Yeah, I was there.
So, and, you know, it was easy to make a 10-layer board with a, you know, 062 overall thickness or an 090, and there was no real constraints about thickness. But now with, you know, 20, 30-plus layers, the boards are getting substantially thicker, and that leads to a number of issues. One is that there could be connector problems. You can't use standard connectors anymore. The other thing is also aspect ratio. At the same time as the boards are getting thicker, we want to make, for routing density, we want to use smaller holes. So that makes a higher aspect ratio, which is tougher for plating.
Yep.
So two things going in, you know, against each other.
Right.
And if you could, and also because now the chip packages are, everything's getting denser, there's more routing that's required, which requires more signal layers. Mm-hmm. So that makes the board, you know, thicker again. And so if you could, the only place that you can basically take thickness out of an overall stack up is between your power and ground planes, and without affecting impedance. If you try to lower the thickness between your signal and your reference plane, either your ground or your power, then you have to either change the delta constant, the line width, and that's not always something that's available to do.
Right.
So the simplest way is just to make your power ground plane go from 6 mils, 8 mils, 4 mils, even down to 2 or even less than 2. And that allows you now the availability to sneak in additional signal planes.
I imagine that helps just on the mechanical side too, right? I'm sure there's constraints from a thickness standpoint.
Yes.
You know, fitting inside, you know, we want to cram everything into these packages. I'm sure thickness becomes an issue as well.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about what the composition of the material actually is?
Okay. Well, like I said, the traditional material that was used for quite a while was nothing more than a 2 mil version of what was in the rest of the stack up.
Mm-hmm.
But with the newer materials, they've now gone to fiberglass reinforced materials have a limitation. It's very hard to get a substrate under 2 mils that is processable because the fiberglass gets very thin. It's very hard for the laminators to make prepreg and to make core. The yields aren't all that particularly good because of any foreign material or voids would short out. And so it turned out that a few companies like ourselves discovered that, you know, a film-based solution is actually a better alternative for when you go below 2 mils. So our product starts at 1 mil and goes thinner. And so we've cut the thickness in half over the traditional material. And we're getting to a point where that thickness reduction actually makes quite a bit of improvement in electrical performance. So going from 2 to 1 is actually pretty significant.
Interesting.
The overall amount of decoupling caps you can remove and the overall performance of the board.
I'm going to take a little side path here, but I've been talking a lot about the part shortages lately, and the caps are a problem also to source. And so is that maybe driving some of this?
Well, you know, it was more of the initial thing about getting ready decoupling caps is that they take up a lot of space. Even though they're tiny, if you look at the types of decoupling caps, they're very small. Some of them are almost invisible.
Yeah.
But you still have to make the vias. You still
exactly.
have to connect them somewhere. And the vias take up space.
Mm-hmm.
And so initially it was more about just freeing up real estate than it was maybe about the availability. But as of late, I just recently had an OEM customer call us in and said, you know, one of the reasons we're looking at this is one is thickness control. The other one is that parts availability. We don't want to have to be at the mercy of the caps, you know, the cap suppliers.
So
and
it's a factor. It's not
an inventory.
Sorry.
But then we have to source, you know, the better off we are.
So it's a factor. It's not a primary driver necessarily, but it's maybe one of a few things that are driving OEMs because that seems to be a huge issue.
Yeah, and it's typically just the smaller caps. I mean, you still need your big tantalum, you know, power supply tech caps, mm-hmm. you know, that operate at the lower frequencies. Those still are needed, but those little hundreds and possibly thousands of little decoupling caps, you know, most of them can be removed now.
Interesting. Well, that seems like a huge benefit as far as real estate goes, particularly in that. So for the engineers and designers that are our listeners here primarily, If this was something that sounded intriguing to them, what are some design considerations they'd have to take into mind if they were wanting to use the materials, and how would that change their design flow?
Well, one of the beauties of this technology is since we're talking about, you know, planar capacitance, where the whole sheet, the whole power ground plane becomes one, is acting like one big capacitor, you don't have to basically physically make cutouts and design little discrete capacitors. It's not like the buried resistor you mentioned earlier where you have to physically place a component. The whole power ground plane becomes one big capacitor. So from that standpoint, there's really not a change to the layout, what you need to do. But what it does do is it frees up all that space that you would have taken up with decoupling capacitors. And usually you're placing your decoupling capacitors close to your chip package, which is the most expensive real estate on the board.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the highest routing density is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get rid of those decoupling capacitors, that gives you, it frees up a lot of real estate. The one thing you do have to do, though, is that because it only works when the power and ground planes are together, there's a number of designs out there that basically have your power plane, your two signal layers, and then a ground plane.
Yeah.
And so the power and ground plane are separated by all this dielectric. And so sometimes we had to work on a design a few times where we actually put in a redundant ground plane just so that we could have that to create that decoupling layer in there. So that's a consideration. You may have to take a 14-layer board. We went on a 14-layer board up to a 16-layer board to do that. Again, it added some costs, but they did see the performance they were expecting out of that.
I see.
So that's probably the biggest consideration, is if you don't typically put your power and ground planes together, you may have to do something like that. And the other thing too is that there are, when it comes to design, fortunately, over the years, when it comes to design tools, I think we all agree that lots of times the tools come after the technology, because you want to see if it's a real technology or not. If the design company is going to invest the resource, especially for simulations and things of that nature. Well, fortunately, this technology has been around a while, that there's really good design, there's really good simulation tools. So what you would typically do is take your stack up and you would substitute the dielectric parameters, the thickness dielectric constant of the power ground planes, and you could simulate and see how many decoupling capacitors you really do need at that point. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that you can eliminate 90%+ of the decoupling capacitors that you think you need. If you added up all the capacitance of these decoupling capacitors and you looked at the capacitance in that power ground plane, you would say, wait a second, there's only 5% of the total capacitance. But again, it's not about capacitance at the higher frequencies you're decoupling, it's about inductance. And at higher frequencies, those little capacitors really act more like inductors. So that's what the real secret is about this technology. That's why I tell people it's kind of a misnomer. We call it embedded capacitance, and it's really more about, reducing inductance.
So along those lines, Rick Hartley spoke at Altium Live in San Diego this year, and he really hammered that home. And people's eyes were popping out of their head like, oh, I never really thought of it like that. And he was talking about placement of the planes and whatever. So I'll make sure to share that talk in the show notes so people can sort of hear the background of that inductance, because I think it'll tie right into this. And Eric.
Eric
was one of our keynotes as well, and I think Eric might have touched on it as well. So I'll share those in the show notes, because I think they touched on the subject that will tie in nicely to what you're saying about inductance.
In fact, if you look at a lot of the industry experts, like the two you just mentioned, Dr. Bruce Archibald and also Isvan Novak, all these people who their lives have been based on signal and power integrity, they're all proponents of the technology. They know it works. And so there's a lot of good articles out there and like you say, talks that really show why this technology works and how you can utilize it.
Well, please make sure to share any of that with me, and we'll put it in the show notes for our listeners so we can sort of tie this all together. Let's go down sort of the laundry list of the benefits that a designer might realize by using this technology.
Okay, so again, I think one thing that we mentioned is the obviously thickness,
right?
And so that you can basically put more layers inside and still maintain your overall board thickness. The other thing too is that reliability. By not having discretes on the surface, there's nothing there that can fail. Mm-hmm. Every component is a potential failure. One of the common defects on very small components is tombstoning, where it basically pops up after assembly or something during assembly. Well, if you don't have a component, that can't happen. And so, and you're eliminating those, those vias. And so, in fact, some studies have been done where some discrete capacitors were put on the surface and put in an oven with a board that used embedded capacitor technology, and they were cycled, and the discrete capacitors failed much quicker than, the board never failed using the embedded capacitors, but the discretes, eventually failed. And so from our reliability, in fact, there's a one manufacturer actually uses very capacitance technology in their black box for the flight recorders, because of the reliability. So it is a very, so that's another, aspect of the technology. And, also, like you mentioned earlier, the placement of the remaining caps. Again, studies have been done showing that once you have this efficient power distribution network, you can actually place your remaining caps further away from the components, from the chip package, because it'll still get the energy it needs in the time allotted, because it's much more efficient. And so it gives you some design flexibility. Lots of times you look at boards, you see everything crammed in the same general area next to the package. This gives you a little bit more flexibility from that respect. Other thing too is that when we put these power and ground planes close together, that actually has a dampening effect on any resonances that can occur in the in that power and ground plane. So when you think about it, you know, the ICs are switching faster and faster, and that energy, it basically goes into the power plane, and that basically at the higher frequencies, it can actually turn some of the components into basically radiators.
Yeah.
And it can also, off the edge of the board, you can have some radiation coming out between the power and ground plane. And it turned out that if you take those layers and put them close together, you greatly reduce the amount of emissions coming off the board.
Okay.
And again, I did a study many years back where we took a, it was a relatively simple board, it's only a 10 layer, but we put it in a, we built it the traditional way and built it with buried capacitance technology and put it in the chamber and measured the what was coming off of it. And there was a quite a significant reduction in the emissions. So that helps with, again, you can either minimize or eliminate possible shielding, from these, from some of these boards.
Interesting. How does it stack up as far as cost goes? I'm thinking that's going to be one of the first things our listeners would be curious about.
Yes. Well, the fortunate thing is that, you know, like any technology, the first adapters are usually ones that have no other way of doing it. And, you know, cost is not as big a concern.
Right.
But because it's been in practice now for dozens of years, the cost of the material has come down from the initial days as people have gotten better at making it. And also the board shops now have higher yields. They know how to handle it. And so the cost, and also at the same time as the cost of these buried capacitance or the embedded capacitor materials have come down, the cost of the remaining materials on the boards have gone up because now you're using higher performance board, highest performance materials.
Right.
So back in the old days, they still were using, you know, more like traditional, you know, high performance epoxies, but they weren't using all these new types of resin systems, which are very expensive.
Right.
And so the delta between the materials is almost insignificant at this point.
Interesting.
And no longer having to pay a licensing or royalty fee, that took a big chunk of the cost delta between that. The only real thing is that because these layers are so thin, they're typically 100% hypot tested after they're etched. So you take your, typically the material is checked at the laminator. The person who's selling the material typically will check it first to make sure that it stands up to 500 volts or whatever the requirement is. And then they'll ship it to the board shop. The board shop will etch the pattern and then do a test on the circuits to make sure they still pass the 500 volt hypot test.
Okay.
And then it'll be built into the board and it'll be hypot tested one more time to make sure that in the building of the board there wasn't anything done to it. So typically it'll get at least two, if not three, hypot tests to make sure that the integrity between those thin layers is being maintained. And so that testing takes, it's a relatively simple test. It's almost no time, but it still is an additional step.
Right.
So again, the cost impacts are minor at this point compared to what they were maybe even, you know, 5-10 years ago.
So how many board shops, you know, as an ex-board fabricator, I'm thinking, how many, you know, kind of what's the percentage of board shops out there that are familiar with using these materials and know how to do it comfortably and well?
Okay. Well, it turns out that almost every domestic, every U.S. board shop has probably done it or is doing it on a regular basis. And then when it comes to the same thing at your major fabricators in Europe and growing in Asia, we know that if you look at it, the board shops that are in Korea do it every single day, and they do quite a bit of it. And then also some of the shops in the higher end shops typically that would be doing it, all goes back to what type of technology. You know, it's almost like, you know, if you go to a board shop here in the U.S., they may not be that great at HDI, you know, building, you know, doing micro V's and things like that, because they don't do it on a regular basis.
Right.
Because their customers don't require it.
Right.
The same thing in Asia. There's quite a few Asian manufacturers that do boards for infrastructure for service routers, with the bigger boards,
right.
And they would be familiar with the technology. The other thing too that's interesting is any military shop is already probably familiar with it because it's really kind of a version of a rigid-flex. If you think about it, materials are basically flexible materials, and it's kind of like a rigid-flex without the flex part sticking out. It's you're basically putting a film material inside a board. And so for that case, even the military shops are very familiar with processing these type of boards.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, even if a board shop, I think most of your listeners probably have at least one of their suppliers that is already familiar with the technology and doing it on a regular basis. And even if they don't have one, it doesn't take much to bring them up to speed. It's not a very hard thing to implement. We have an example on our website. We have some design guidelines. There are some little things in manufacturing from, like the border pattern. You want to make sure you retain as much copper as possible so you can have easier handling, things of that nature. So that's those are the type of things that, these little tiny subtle things which are not hard to teach to a board shop.
So John, this has been fabulous and something I didn't know much about, and it's been really great to learn about it. I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed it as well. And this has been a short kind of drinking from the fire hose, but where can listeners get more information? Of course, any links that you send to me, I'll make sure we put in the show notes. But, first steps, if somebody listened to this and said, this is going to solve my problems, where do they go immediately to find you or find a distributor for your materials, or where do they go?
Okay. Well, first of all, just one, we did create, the IPC did create standards. And I know that designers love to have standards. It's something that we could basically go to and refer to. And so the IPC standard is 4821 for the embedded, embedded passive devices capacitor. It's basically the sister standard to the resistor one.
Okay.
So we had this group of us many years ago sat down and we came up with all the standards for embedded components. So
great.
Concentrated resistors and capacitors. There's also a design guideline 2316, which also now it takes the next level so that people can look, and it gives the overall description of the technology and how to use it. But then again, like I said, also if you look at our website, which will be included in the show notes, we have some design guidelines. We have a PDF you can download of the design guidelines as well as the overall description of the technology. And even just Googling, embedded capacitor technology or buried capacitance technology, either one will get you quite a few articles that I've written over the years as well as others, on the technology.
Okay,
but,
great.
We have a group at DuPont that were willing to go out to the customer and explain the technology, look at their designs, give them some suggestions, and pretty much most of the field engineering application people for the board shops are very familiar with the technology.
Okay.
So they can even actually talk right with their suppliers.
Wonderful.
Hey, I'm interested in this technology. And then they would get us involved.
So will you be having a booth at IPC Apex that's coming up at the end of January?
Yes, we will have a booth at the IPC Apex. We have a booth, and also we have our distributor here in the U.S. is Inselectro, so we'll be right by them. And so
okay.
We generally share a lot of the IPC and those type of things with them. They've been an excellent distributor of our products.
Great.
Over the years.
Yeah, Chris Hunrath is sort of a regular here on our podcast. He's so technically rich and deep.
Yeah,
he's a great guy.
We're glad he's on the team there and helping us out.
Well, if anybody out there in our listening audience is going to IBC Apex, make sure to stop by and see the folks at DuPont or Inselectro where you can get more information. We'll share everything that John's talked about in our show notes. John, is there anything else we need to share before we wrap up here?
Well, also, They are against each other, but the Design Con in Santa Clara, I would be there personally for that. And so if someone wants to, reach out to me, we can arrange to meet there. So I'll be at that show as well.
Okay.
So we'll be covering both. I'm on the technical committee for Design Con, so I'll be both at the. So we'll have people both up here in Santa Clara and down in San Diego.
Okay, very good. Well, can't thank you enough. This has been great. It's been really interesting information.
Okay, thank you very much for the chance to discuss the technology.
My pleasure. Well, for our listeners, thanks again for joining us for another episode of On Track. We always love to have you. Please comment, give us your ideas for future episodes. We'll see you next time. Until then, remember to always stay on track.